Good morning, everyone. My name is Greg, one of the pastors here. Really, really glad that you're here this morning. And we've actually named this sermon, just to get you ready for it, an awkward commercial break. And I'm going to tell you why, because it's awkward. And so we're going to jump in to awkward together. And I feel like if I just name that on the front end, it might be less awkward by calling it awkward. And so that's where we're going to go. But we're going to start. I want to share with you a bit about a 2017 poll that was done by Ipsos. And they were looking at 20 different countries, trying to get a feel for what was going on in the minds of people when they thought about religion. And in particular, we're not talking about Christianity or Islam or Hinduism, but religion as a whole. And the question in particular that caught my attention is this one. Do you agree with this statement? Religion does more harm in the world than good. And the response to that from the United States of America, 39% of people agreed with that. 39%, roughly 4 in 10, were saying, yes, religion does more harm than good in the world. In the country of Great Britain, it was actually higher, 61%, 6 in 10, were saying, yeah, religion does more harm in the world than good. If we look to the country of Australia, Australia would say that actually it's 63% of them saying that. And then if we make our way to Belgium, it's where it was the worst. Belgium, actually, the country of Belgium said 68% of them said, yeah, religion does more harm in the world than good. Roughly 7 in 10 people. And so when we think about that, for me in particular, I started drilling down and wondering, just wondering, because the question wasn't about Christianity, it was about religions. I just wondered, where have we participated in people answering toward the negative on that? Answering that, yes, it's done more harm in the world than it has good over the history of this world. And then I started thinking about my own life, and I invite you to think about your life and about us. Where have we participated in or lived in a way or done things over the 2,000-year history of the church or over your 10-year, 20-year, 50-year, 60-year history of your life, where have we participated in causing people to begin to think about religion in this world actually bringing more harm than good? Because here's the reality. I think it's true. We could own it if we take an honest look. And if you're new here to Fairhaven, maybe this is your first Sunday, I want you to know that we keep it real here. We try to be honest, even if it's tough to face. Even if it's hard, we want to be honest. We want to be real. The truth is that I would say that Christianity, over its 2,000-year history, or my 50-plus year history, or yours, all of us would be able to say that we brought good to the world, and also we maybe have done some harm. Not maybe, we have done some harm in the way we have behaved or acted, so that some people would say, and you're a Christian, or that's Christian. Because when we look at Christianity as a whole, no question, it's brought incredible good to the world. And we could spend an entire series of sermons on what the world has received as a result of Christ instituting the church and us then living it out. When we think about things like charity, or we think about true religion, it cares for the widows and the orphans, and to see the elevation of widows and orphans and the care and love, not just those people that are in proximity to you that are part of your family, but Christianity launched this thing that Jesus said. Yeah, you've heard it said that you're to love those that you like, those that you care for, but I'm going to tell you to love even those that are difficult to love, people that you would consider your enemies. And love became a mantra that the church lived out in beautiful ways. And we also know that in the name of Jesus, kind of hiding behind Jesus, if you will, or misunderstanding Jesus, or living in a way that you're using Jesus, the church has done some awful things over its 2,000-year history. Religion does more harm in the world than good. There's a guy named John Dixon. He was a theologian from Australia that was going to speak on this very topic. And in speaking on this topic, he drilled down to something that I know is absolutely true. And it's this right here, that our destination is determined by our direction, not our intentions. So you can intend to do good, but if your direction takes you to a place that isn't good, no matter what your intentions were, you're going to end up in the wrong place. Think about it this way. My wife, she just went to Florida, and she's down there with her family. She grew up in Florida. She wanted to go down to Florida, and I went, no way. It's too hot down there, and then we had as hot weather up here. I'm like, I should have went with her. But she went down to Florida, and so she asked me to drop her off at the airport, and she took the really early one. And so 4 o'clock in the morning, we're on the road. The intention is to get her to the airport, right? And if my directions were not correct, they were, but if my intention was to get her to the airport, but because we woke up early and I was tired and I just didn't pay attention, we could have ended up someplace else. And our direction, the turns that you take, actually bring you to whatever destination you end up at. Just because you want to go somewhere doesn't mean you're going to get there unless you take the right turns. Well, this guy, John Dixon, theologian, author, professor, he had this desire to really get at, has the church ended up at the wrong destination at times? Or are we the kind of church that actually brings good to the world, more good than harm? And so what he did, prior to showing up to teach, he spent 5 days prior to that, went to a musician and said, I want to learn the cello. He had 5 days. I just want to learn the cello. And what I want to learn is I want to learn Bach's Prelude to Cello, number 1, and in G form here. Whatever the G is, I don't know. Where's Mackenzie? Wherever she is. So in G. And so he started practicing for 5 days, got up and he played this thing before the audience, which I think is pretty brave. So he's never held a cello in his life. 5 days in, he's playing the cello for them. Bach's rendition of Cello Suite, the prelude to it. And he got all done, put the cello aside. And then a concert cellist, a famous concert cellist, came out and played the exact same thing. And his point was this. If all you knew about Bach is what you heard me, after 5 days of practice, show you, you would think that Bach had no genius to him, that his music was not worth listening to, that he was a hack. And yet, when the concert pianist or cellist comes out and plays, you can begin to feel the movement and begin to feel the beauty in this thing. It reminds me of times that I've sat with Mackenzie and I have this song that I've listened to and I went, man, we need to sing this at church. And I start sharing it with her and she's like, I'm not sure I know the song. I go, let me sing it for you. And I've done it. And so I start singing it for her and she's like, I don't know the song. I'm like, yeah, I know you know it. And then I play it for her and she goes, oh, yeah, that's not what you were singing. This is a different song. Completely different song. I'm like, no, it's the same song. But same cellist, same song, same very different tune. One beautiful and good, one harmful and not good. And what Dixon said is, there's something about the original, something about beauty that has the counterfeit or the not so beautiful, not look good at all. And then he said this, that Christians, when they're out of tune with the masterpiece of the master, Christ has a way of making Christians look bad. Not his intention to make us look bad, no way. But because of the beauty that he is, when stacked up against it, when we're not living in that way, it's obvious. It becomes obvious. 3 out of 10, 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10 start going, wait. And again, that's about all religions, not just Christianity, which led us A year and a half ago, led us, Jeremy and I, along with some of the other pastors in the Harbor churches, to really lean in and say, we want to get serious about the words and the ways of Jesus, and we want to sing in tune with Jesus. We want to be a church that's in tune with the words and the way of Jesus, and we leaned in for an entire year, leaned into the gospel that we might learn the ways of Jesus and live the ways of Jesus in a beautiful way in this world to really be good news and to be the right kind of tune for the world to see. And in that journey, actually, as we dove into it, what we saw was that when Jesus described himself, and that's what we were going after, who's Jesus and what does he look like? How does he live and how does he love? We saw that he described himself by going all the way back to the beginning, which led us back to the beginning in this book of Genesis that we've been studying for some 6 months, going after the very beginnings. And we chased the story from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. And then last week launched this mini series on Joseph. And today, unlike the others, we went from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. Joseph's story is introduced and then he disappears for a minute. All of chapter 38 is about Judah and Tamar. And it's really awkward. And the story, it's really graphic. And the story, as you read it this morning with me, I would ask you to wonder with me, why is this in here? Why this break from the story that goes from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to Joseph? What's the break all about? And this story is a lot of things, but one of the things that it is it's in the Bible. And because it's in there, we're not going to ignore it as we're studying the scripture together. So chapter 38, just to give you a bit of backdrop on it real quick, Joseph is not in this story, but Judah is. And Judah has three sons, and his sons, the oldest is the next is Onan, and the final is Shelah. And these three sons are part of the story. So let's read it together. Genesis chapter 38, verses 6 through 26. And as we go through this, I just want you to know that we're going to be reading from the ESV. And the reason is it's slightly less graphic. So here we go. And Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. Like, okay, time out already. Like, what? And this is where the story of the East meets up with the West. The story of the old meets up with the new. The story of the then meets up with the now. The story that is this meets up with us right here, because that story already, we have words for what we just read, and I would use just two, messed up, right? From our perspective, from West to East, from ancient to modern, we got a different kind of understanding. He does the duty, and you think, what is that? What is that? And we're going to dive into it a little bit more, but just briefly, I want to back us up to Abraham and Sarah. And there was a moment where they didn't have children and they needed children. And we shared from the pulpit here a little bit about the ancient culture. They didn't have 401ks. They didn't have Roth IRAs. They didn't have pension plans. There was no such thing as Social Security. There was no blanket for them at the end of their life when they no longer had earning power or ability, or their body began to give way. The way they did it was when you cared for your kids when they couldn't care for themselves, eventually when you can't care for yourself, your kids care for you. So Tamar, her husband no longer with her. She has no children. You could say, in a sense, she has no retirement plan at all. It won't go well, and there's certainly way, way more to it than just that. But already we can see this story is different. The culture is different, and Onan is responsible to give her a son. Let's read on. But Onan knew that this offspring would not be his. The way it would be your brother's son. That's how it would be. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord. And he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shears, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance of Eniam, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? He answered, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge until you send it. If you give me a pledge until you send it. And he said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her, and he went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of the place, where's the cult prostitute who was at Eniam at the roadside? And they said, no cult prostitute has been here. So he returned to Judah and said, I've not found her. Also the men of the place said, no cult prostitute has been here. And Judah replied, let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her. About 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these things belong, I am pregnant. And she said, please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. Then Judah identified them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah. Like, wow, right? My guess is you did not think we were going to read that in church on this morning, right? Like, wow, what a story. What a story. And in some ways, we could say we really don't need to unpack a story. And in other ways, we would say, yeah, there's some things that feel like a bit of a mystery because East meets West, or the ancient meets the modern, or the olds meeting the new, the thens meeting up with the now. And there's some things to unpack here to actually get a feel for it. But Judah, he was the head of the household, which means he was over the family in such a way that he was responsible for his family. And we referred to that here the way they would have referred to it then. He was the leader of their Beit Av, the leader of their family. And as such, things, especially for a widow, were necessary to make sure that you secured her financial, the economic side of it, her status in society, and her legal status. All three of these were at jeopardy. If you were a widow and not under the covering of a Beit Av, not under the covering of a family, you would be at jeopardy socially, you would be at jeopardy economically, you would be at jeopardy legally, you'd be left in a place. Tamar losing Ur as her husband, having no child, no son to carry on the family name, no ability for her, except under this family covering, to really make a life for herself. She was in a place that was tenuous if Judah didn't do right for her. In fact, her life, and I'm not going to go way into it here today because we don't have time for it, but what would have been for her would have been a life of sheer misery. It would have been absolutely, absolutely difficult for her. And so what Judah does is he does right by her. He knows the law. There's a levirate law that would say that what needs to take place in order to secure, in order to care for, in order for this woman that's in your Beit Av, your daughter-in-law, who you took into your family and said you would provide for her economic, for her social, for her legal covering. You would be the one that would protect her and take care of her. What you need to do is secure her future by giving her a son, and it is your responsibility within this Beit Av to give another son to her that she might have a child by this one. And he did right, and Onan was given. But Onan didn't do right, and we read it. It's not hard to figure out, and I'm sure it wasn't hard to figure out, right? Not hard to figure out either for Tamar what was happening. And in this case, Onan, what's going on? Well, if she has a son, it won't be mine. If she has a son, then right now it's me and Shelah that are left of the inheritance, but another one, the inheritance gets split again. He thinks nothing of her, thinks nothing of her future, thinks nothing of what might happen to her if this doesn't happen. He thinks only of himself, and then he, too, displeases God greatly and dies. There's another son left. Still have another son. And at this point, the story takes a left turn for Judah, too. Right now, he's been doing right by her, but at this point, he starts thinking about something else. Time out. I've lost Ur. I've lost Onan. I only have one son left. And then he speaks these words to Tamar. Remain a widow in your father's house. Tell Shelah, my son grows up. At first blush, we would look at that and go, that makes some sense. He must be too young. He's too little, and he can't give her a child yet. And so, and go spend time with your dad. Go to your family home. Go travel. Like my wife right now, go spend time with your siblings and go enjoy life there. This is a little more than that. She's under the Beit Av at this point, under the family protection of Judah. And Judah says, why don't you go back to your dad's Beit Av? Why don't you go back to your dad's covering? And Shelah, when my son grows up, I'll give him to you so that you can have a son by him. You liar. You liar. Because what's next proves he's lying. For he feared that he would die, that Shelah would die like his brothers. This is why he's sending her away. In other words, so typical. So blind, actually. It couldn't be Ur's fault that he died, and it couldn't be Onan's fault. That's not possible. It's got to be Tamar's fault. Let's send the problem away. And so he does, with zero intention of ever, ever fulfilling the levirate law and securing for her, as he promised when he brought her into the family, her economic and her social and her legal status. Go and maybe you can be somebody else's problem. But the problem, at least in his mind, it comes back, and she really wasn't the problem. He was at this point. All right, we read the story. What he does is he loses his wife. He's making his way down the road, and he sees what he believes to be a cult prostitute, and he propositions her and ends up with her. Although he doesn't know this at the moment, it's actually Tamar who knows that her future is so insecure. She is absolutely desperate. She needs to take a move, and she does the best she can because he said he would provide. He said he would protect. He isn't doing this. Shelah's of age and hasn't come to her, and so she goes and sleeps with him, has a baby by him, and 3 months later shows up to him, and he's exposed. He's exposed at that point. And I know the story. It's like, wow, especially if you stay in the West, if you stay in the modern, if you stay in the now, the story, you go, yeah, I got two words for it too, messed up on so many levels, except if you go to the ancient and if you go to the east and you go to the then and you think this was the law of the land because it was a way of caring for and leading into, and it was a way of providing for and making sure you secure future for. And all of this is taken from her. And at this moment when Judah has an opportunity to still exercise his authority over her, what does he do? He hears, Tamar has been immoral. Tamar has done wrong. Oh, are you kidding me? Let's do away with her. Burn her. Go get her, bring her out, and burn her. I mean, even that. Leave her alone, at least. At least leave her alone. But no, he has the power to do something about it. And he exercises that power. And at that moment, she throws out the signet, the staff. Whose items are these? Now, Judah's got an opportunity to do one of two things at that point because he recognizes this is my stuff. Wow. No wonder we couldn't find the cult prostitute. It's me. It's me who is with her. This is my child that's in her womb. And what's he going to do? What's he do at that point? Because he got a couple opportunities. He's in a position of power. He's in a position. He can make this thing go away. He can sweep it under the rug. He can make it disappear by making her disappear. Or he can come face to face with himself and own it. And it's at this moment something I think beautiful starts to happen in Judah. He recognizes, I'm playing out of tune over here. I didn't start that way, but I've been playing out of tune for a while. And it's not very beautiful. I've been strumming this thing in a way that's not real great. And when you put me up against her, she's living right, and she's trying to do right by this stuff, and she's more righteous than I. I want to invite the band to come forward at this point. Our praise band, come on up, and I want us to think about our own lives as they come up here. Because within each of us, if we're honest enough and we're willing to face enough, this is a story, and maybe this is why this story's in there. Maybe this is here to give us an opportunity within the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and within every story, here's what's true about all the way back to the beginning. Adam, Eve, and then Cain and Abel, and then we've got Abraham and Isaac, and you get the story of Moses, and it doesn't matter. You take any story of any human being, and what you find in there is this tremendous capacity for good, and then this really good ended up at a destination going, how did I get here? I never intended to get here. This was not my intention to land here, but your direction actually brought you there. How many people I've had conversations with over the years that have shared with me, I never, ever thought I would end up doing, you name it, that. I never thought I would end up in this place. In a place where all of a sudden you're face to face with yourself, and Judas face to face with himself and thinking, what is this I've done? This was my, my daughter-in-law. I brought her into the family. I brought her into my Beit Av and said I would provide for her and I would care for her. And I started good, and then I sent her on her way. I was ready to undo her, and now I'm being undone. I'm being undone. She's more righteous than me. And before God, before people, he just kind of came to the end of himself and said, I don't like the direction this is going. I don't like what I'm seeing. It's time for a change. And he did right by that. It's time for a change. And he declared, she is singing a more beautiful tune than I am, and it's time for me to reset. As the band leads us through the song, I want to invite us into our own stories. This is a story, a commercial break in this greater story that's in the book of Genesis, but maybe a break for you and a break for me to have a moment to think about our own lives and where might God be inviting us into something more beautiful.